Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Today's episode is presented by Meta.
A virtual reality platform created by Fundamental VR and Orbis International helps train doctors to treat cataracts, resulting in more confident surgeons operating worldwide. Meta and the metaverse are having impact today.
I think that we are able to deliver quicker and stronger than I think anybody expected from the Commission.
Welcome to another special episode of EU Confidential. I'm Andrew Gray, Politico's EU editor in Brussels. Hope you're all holding up okay. This is the second of our extra weekly episodes devoted to how Europe is coping with the coronavirus crisis. Coming up today, we'll talk to our health team about the prospects of a coronavirus vaccine, and we'll look at how EU countries are starting to help one another and ask how long that might last. We'll also hear about people for whom COVID-19 is particularly dangerous. But first, let's talk to someone very directly involved in Europe's response to the crisis, the European Commissioner for Home Affairs, Ylva Johansson, who you also heard at the very start of the podcast. She's one of eight commissioners coordinating the EU's coronavirus response. I spoke to the Commissioner a bit earlier today. Commissioner Johansson, thanks very much for joining us on EU Confidential. One of your jobs at the moment is looking at the internal borders within the European Union. We saw lots of countries take measures to close down or severely restrict access to their borders as a result of this crisis. What's the current situation right now with the internal borders within the EU, within the Schengen zone, and what ones are causing you concern?
The situation right now is that many of the member states have restrictions for entry to their territory, but we have been working very hard the last week together with the member states, and they also asked us for guidelines and coordination to make this work smoothly. So there have been a lot of big improvement the last days when it comes both for the goods to let through and also for citizens. There could be still some problems, but I think that the atmosphere is very constructive in solving these problems together with member states and neighbouring member states.
Which are the areas when you kind of look at your map of Europe, what's kind of flashing red at the moment? Where are the biggest border problems right now?
Well, it depends. Well, we had some problem after Serbia has closed their borders very sharp also for their own citizens. So this is one of the area we need to solve, of course. But overall, I must say that I think that the reaction from many member states was in the beginning to react, oh, there is a virus coming, we have to close the borders. But then I think more and more, many of them realize that this virus is in all member states. So we can't stop the virus because it's already there. What we can do is to limit contagion and to do that by limiting social interaction. And of course, traveling is part of social interaction. So that's why it makes sense to limit that. But we have to do it in a proportionate way so that we do not hamper economy or the ability for people to get to their job and things like that more than necessary. And this is the reaction I see right now.
But aren't there particular, the one we've heard about is the Hungarian border in particular. There seemed to be a problem with Romanians being able to even get home. Is that one resolved now?
Yeah, that's what the information I got, that I think this has improved a lot. And if I just want to make some comment, I think that sometimes your first reaction is to, you know, trying to save yourself. You can see it on an individual basis where people go to shops and buy toilet paper and pasta. And but after a while, you realize that this is not what I need. What I need is good neighbors so that they can help me when I in trouble or if I need somebody to help me to go to the shop and do things like that. And I think this is the same reaction we see among member states. Of course, there's always new problems popping up and we are dealing with them. But this is not this thing that keeps me awake during night, I must say.
Mm. What does keep you awake at night?
It's the situation with the migration, according to the virus. That's one of the things that keeps me awake.
Sorry, could you just explain a bit more?
Well, there are two kinds of problem, both that we are still have arrivals of irregular migrants to European Union, but there is more or less no that could be returned to the country of origin. And there's also problems with the relocation. So this is, of course, a problem for countries of first entry. And, of course, you are all very much aware of the situation on the hotspots on the Greek islands, where for some, a lot of people, the situation has been unacceptable already before this corona crisis. And, of course, the risk of having the virus in those camps is a really dangerous one.
Yeah, and I was going to ask you about that later. I mean, what can you as the Commission, what can the Greek authorities do to try and prevent that scenario? What are you doing at the moment?
We are supporting the Greek authorities, of course. I spoke with the Greek minister today, just a few hours ago. So we are in constant contact, trying to find good solutions. The situation right now, as the minister explained to me, is that the virus is not on the islands and they have put more or less all islands in a kind of quarantine. Nobody are allowed to enter there, trying to keep the virus out. And of course, that sounds a good thing to do, but it still remains also what shall we do if the virus turns up, even though. So this is one of the issues that we are in constant contact with and discussing also together with organizations like UNHCR, IOM, Médecins Sans Frontières, how they also can help to have a better capacity on the islands.
Are things moving on that? I mean, are you confident if there were to be an outbreak that, you know, there's capacity there to deal with it?
I mean, the situation was not acceptable even before the crisis of corona. And of course, it's not easier now to solve it. But we are still working constantly on this. And we're also working on the relocation of unaccompanied minors from the Greek hotspots. And I'm hope that we can be able to carry that out, even though we need to take some additional measures when it comes to quarantine and testing.
Okay, if we come back to the internal borders briefly, can you just explain to our listeners why this is such a big deal, keeping those borders open? Because a lot of people may think, well, if the whole problem is movement, the one way to stop movement is to close down borders, stop people moving around. So why is this such a big deal? What are the implications if things don't move freely through the borders?
Well, what we need to do is to limit contagion, and that's why we need to limit social interaction. But to be able to limit social interaction, we also need to have a lot of ordinary things going so that people can go to their jobs, so that all their foods and the goods that we need can be there, so we don't cause additional problems that will also be damaging the possibility to limit social interaction. That's one thing. The other thing is also, of course, that we need the economy to keep on going, even now it's on a lower level, but it's important that we can supply each other with the goods that we need, and not at least for medical equipment. So all these things need to be there. Our food need to be there. A lot of goods need to be there. That's why we should not act in a way so that what we are doing to protect ourselves turns up to be acting in the opposite direction.
Are there any concrete examples, just to help our listeners understand, of that have worried you of medical equipment or of particularly valuable goods that have been held up because of this? And are you aware of specific examples of that nature?
Well, I'm not sure whether I should sit here and talk about bad examples, because we're actually solving things now. So a lot of these have been solved. Yeah. But we was in a situation where trucks were stuck in long queues for hours and hours and hours, and everybody can understand this is not a good situation. Or if people are crowded at the borders and can't get through, this is of course not good for limiting the contagion. And then we need a lot of supply for example, when Commissioner Kyriakides called out to all member states to find out whether they have pharmaceuticals enough, and they answered, yes, we have, but they are now stuck in queues. So the supply chains was a problem, not actually the capacity. So these are examples of why it's important that this will go in a smooth way. And also that we have a lot of cross-border workers that are really essential for example, having the healthcare systems in some member states to work in a proper way. And of course, if these people can't get to their job or home from their job, then we will have severe problems in some important services.
And how is the Commission in general handling this? Obviously, this is a big crisis for a Commission that's only been in office for a short time. Can you give us a general sense? I believe you're part of the daily task force that meets every day. Give us a sense of your typical day, or how the Commission is structuring its response to this.
Yes, my typical day is a very, very long day, and it's 7 days a week. So we have every morning at 9 for this group of commissioners that are mostly involved, and it's led by the president. And then we go through the different tasks for the day. Usually takes 1 hour. It's quite focused on operational things. And then we work during the days with these tasks, and that includes a lot of contacts with member states, and for me, a lot of ministers bilaterally, and also video conferences. I have video conference with my ministers 3 times last week, gonna be 2 times this week. We have a special COVID border group that meet, discussing and solving issues with the borders. Of course, a lot of direct contact with other commissioners. So there's a lot of contacts. And I think that, of course, this has to be evaluated afterwards if things could be done even better. But so far, I think that we have been able to deliver quicker and stronger than I think anybody expected from the Commission in this case, because in many of these areas the Commission do not have the formal competence, but we have been given the competence, so to say, asked by the member state to take this role, and we have been taking it. And you can see also practical things like some member state had export bans on medical equipment. There have been some other problems that we've been able to solve by a lot of direct bilateral contacts, and also helping member states to have direct contacts with their neighboring member states, facilitating these kind of problem solving platforms, so to say.
Mm. A final question, maybe just on how you personally are handling all of this. You're fairly new to Brussels, to being based, to being a full-time EU official. I imagine you have family back in Sweden. You know, how are you managing? I think everyone is, you know, faces these situations where you're separated from loved ones. Social life is severely restricted. How do you personally deal with all of that?
Well, my husband is coming to me, so he's here right now. But of course, I miss my children. They are grown up now, but I talk to them. But I'm longing to hug them also. I hope maybe there will be an opportunity in Easter, but let's see how things develop.
Yeah, thank you. And I hope we can talk again. I believe you're Am I correct in saying you're a fan of Hammarby, the football team?
Hammarby and Liverpool are my two teams.
Okay. Well, I don't know how well you know your Hammarby history, but my team, St Mirren, Scottish football team, were beaten by Hammarby in very traumatic circumstances many years ago. So maybe in happier times we can talk about that.
Yeah, we're happy to do. The start of the National League in Sweden has been postponed for, I guess, 1 or 2 months. So that's a pity.
Yeah, we're all missing football, among many other things, although it's fairly trivial.
But that's really one of the hard things, you know, living without any football at all.
Just when we could use a distraction. Commissioner, thanks very much for your time. Very much appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks to Commissioner Johansson. And now let's welcome the hardest working team in healthcare coverage right now, Politico's own team of health reporters. Hi to Sarah Wheaton. Hi, Sarah.
Hey there.
Hi to Gillian Deutsch.
Hello.
And also to Carmen Pound. Hi, Carmen.
Hi, Andrew.
How's everybody doing with the home working so far? Adjusting, or is it a bit of a struggle?
It's a bit of a struggle, especially when you have a toddler that takes your hand and takes your headsets away and then steps on them and then beats your computer with a carrot because you've been in front of it for too long. This has all just happened to me in 2 days. Yeah.
I'm a big fan of audio, but just, I wish we'd had video there because I can see on the connection here that Carmen kind of wiped her weary eyes there. She was telling us that story. Sarah, Gillian, you guys doing okay?
Yeah, luckily for me, it's just two pesky cats running around, so a little bit less havoc, I think.
Likewise, I have a dog who is annoyed that I am at home, but I'm not taking him for a walk. And basically, all I'm doing is preventing him from sneakily sitting on the couch, which I know he likes to do when I'm not home, even though he's not allowed.
Yeah, well, I think we're all getting even better at pet mind reading, right, these days. let's get to the business at hand. There's been, so much of it. Time moves in such a strange way at the moment. But last week, I think we talked a bit, Sarah, about the prospects of a vaccine for the coronavirus. And since then, there's been quite a lot of talk about that, led by the European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen. Can you just fill us in on what she's been saying and what your own reporting says about the prospects of a vaccine anytime soon?
She posted a tweet saying that a company that the EU has given some financial help to may well have a vaccine, quote, on the market, perhaps before autumn. And that just came out of nowhere because nobody who knows the process of developing vaccines seems to think that that's realistic at all. Both regulators and scientists have repeatedly been saying it will take at least a year, if we're really lucky, maybe a year and a half, maybe longer. So we asked her what she was thinking.
Sarah Wheaton with Politico. President von der Leyen, today you posted a video on Twitter.
Her answer was, well, this is what the company told me.
So they are highly specialized in this field, and it's their prediction that they might be able towards fall to have the possibility to have a vaccine that is fighting coronavirus.
It was and when we asked if she was going to do something to speed up the regulatory process, she was like, well, we can speed up all of these bureaucratic processes.
Yes, I think as we are in a severe crisis, we all see that we are able to speed up any of the processes that are slow normally and take a lot of time and are very bureaucratic. We all know
it was quite a striking remark from a doctor who seemed to be suggesting that clinical trials to determine whether things are safe and actually work are just bureaucracy.
Yeah, she seems to be out on a limb a little bit there. Obviously, the main investor of this company, CureVac, which has been at the centre of a lot of attention, the one that she spoke to, has also kind of raised that timeline as something that would be, ideal or desirable. But as you say, and as your own reporting has shown, the EU's own regulator in this area and many others, including French President Emmanuel Macron, who came out towards the end of the week and said, we're talking sort of winter, not even this coming winter, but the following winter. So, at the very least more confusing kind of messaging there from European leaders.
Right. And the only other leader who seems to be talking about the same sort of timeline as the Commission president is U.S. President Donald Trump. that happened well before President von der Leyen made her comments, and he was repeatedly criticized and contradicted by his own experts. So we don't usually think of the two of them as being the same sort of communicator, and it was quite striking to see them both kind of stand firm on this same really unjustified optimism.
Yeah, and it's also worth noting, like, when I call vaccine experts about this and tell them what Ursula von der Leyen said, they actually just start laughing. That's usually like the first response that I've heard. So experts are not necessarily getting in line with this. It's very optimistic time frame from the commission president.
It's not really even that it was optimistic. It was kind of just incorrect, because this vaccine, they already pretty much have formulated it. It needs to go into clinical trials. And if things are kind of working smoothly, they'll only have finished the first phase of those clinical trials by autumn. And that just basically tells us whether the vaccine is generally safe in the short term, not even really whether it works or what dosage. And so in order for her prediction to be correct, we would have to just eliminate the tests to see whether the vaccine actually works. So it's not a question of people just like working harder or having more money thrown into the system.
Let's switch to another aspect of all of this, which is the lockdowns, which have been spreading across Europe, more and more restrictive measures on movements, on gathering. Carmen, this is something you've been looking into, particularly after the Belgian health minister made some remarks which were interpreted to mean kind of lockdown for 8 weeks. What have you been finding out about how long this might last?
I did see clarification from her spokesperson about whether she meant 8 weeks of restrictions or 8 weeks of something else. And he did say that she was not referring to confinement or restrictions, that she was talking about the virus being among us, about flattening the curve. And obviously, no one really knows how long the restrictions will last. He did clarify that so far they're in place until when the Belgian prime minister said. And then obviously, they do evaluate it based on the evolution of the situation and the risk management. And of course, that might change. We've seen already the restriction being extended in Spain, being tightened in Italy. There are discussions about that in France too. So if I am to make a forecast, it might last a bit longer than maybe the initial dates, but no one really knows.
Right. Yeah. And on the even more serious kind of human impact of all of this, you know, often we understand that the people most at risk are the elderly, people over 70, over 80. But Gillian, you've been talking or focusing on another group of people who would also be greatly at risk from the spread of the virus. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, I've been talking to some people who are immunocompromised. I mean, their immune systems are not quite as capable of fighting off the coronavirus if they were to contract it. And so I don't want to forget that there's a huge mental health aspect to this, because not only are these people facing potentially a much, much more serious physical side effects if they were to get sick, but they're just living right now in fear that they're going to get it. And so I spoke to a psychotherapist in Italy who works with patients with pulmonary fibrosis, and he was saying that these are also already patients that have a depression. And right now, they're now living in fear that their caregivers are going to be the ones who bring them the virus. And so they actually are being encouraged, of course, to live in isolation, which makes their depression much worse. But then they're worried, too, that if they were to contract the virus, are they going to end up in a hospital and die alone? I mean, they're facing some really very legitimate and really horrible, scary fears.
Right. And these are people whose immune system is weakened for various reasons, right? What would be the most common?
Patients with cancer who are currently seeking treatment or who've just recovered from treatment are a bit more at risk, but also people with diabetes, cardiovascular disease. These are people whose immune systems would have a much harder time fending off the disease if they were to, or fending off the virus if they were to get it. That doesn't necessarily mean that they're more at risk of getting it. That's often a miscommunication. But if they were to get the virus, they would have a much harder time becoming healthy again.
Okay, and if we look at, as I say, time moves really strangely at the moment. Any kind of markers, any kind of next decision points or decisions that are going to have to be made by political leaders, by health ministers or scientific experts? I'm going to open this up to any of you. What do you think are the next kind of key decisions or decision points that we're likely to see in the kind of days or the next week or so as we look ahead?
Well, we're about to enter an upsetting period, arguably, because actually people who were exposed to the virus before these lockdowns started last week are really going to just start getting sick and going to the hospital now. It takes about a week or so, a little longer, to really get bad symptoms brewing up. And so we're going to be in this situation where everybody feels like they're making a big sacrifice, but they're still seeing these horrible outcomes. And I think we'll probably start seeing health ministers pushing for extensions of these lockdowns. But at the same time, we're also going to see tension with political leaders and businesses saying, look, you know, how long are we really going to shut down the economy? And especially if people are looking at the hospital and saying, hey, everybody's getting sick anyway, that's going to create kind of two dueling pressures. You'll have kind of one side saying, well, this shows we need to lock down even more. You'll have another side saying, what's the point of any of this? And we don't really have the knowledge to say that either side is more or less correct.
Okay, maybe a final one for both you, Carmen, and Gillian. There was a lot of talk at the beginning of this crisis of a lack of European solidarity. Felt like every country was doing its own thing and really thinking first and foremost and perhaps only about its own citizens. Have we seen any signs in terms of sharing of equipment or even hospital beds being made available that's changing at all? Carmen?
Yes, we've seen the first transfers of patients, although granted it's in a border area. It's between France, Germany, Luxembourg and Switzerland. So a few German regions and Luxembourg and Switzerland took a few patients from the neighboring region of France. I guess we would need to see whether that happens with Italy, which seems to be really overwhelmed right now, and if other countries will be able to take them. There might also be an issue regarding the transportation of these patients, whether they need to be transported on a short distance and not very far. And we have also seen a relaxation of export bans on protective equipment, but it hasn't happened across the board. So while countries like Germany have lifted it, there are still countries in Central and Eastern Europe, like Czech Republic and Romania, who are still banning exports of this kind of equipment and also of some medicines that are used to treat the complications of the virus.
Yeah, and actually you saw this at the end of last week, some face masks that were sent from China to Italy that were first sent to Czech Republic to get to Italy, they were actually seized by the Czech government. And the Czech government said that they thought that they were going to be sold on the black market, so they wanted to confiscate them. But NGOs have said that it's quite clear from the packaging that this was humanitarian aid from China. The Czech Republic has said that they're sorry that they did this, essentially, and that they're going to send some of their own face masks now to Italy. But there's definitely some tension between countries that have export bans and who seem to be taking some of this gear for themselves.
Okay, well, let's see how that progresses in the days and weeks ahead. I'll let you guys all get back to stories, which I know you're all working on. And, for now, we'll talk to you again very soon at the very latest next Monday. And in the meantime, you know, stay healthy. And that's all we have time for on this special episode of EU Confidential. I'll be back on Thursday with our regular podcast panel, and we'll bring you special coronavirus episodes for the foreseeable future. As much as anything is foreseeable these days. If you have an idea for a topic you'd like us to report on, please email us at podcast@politico.eu and feel free to send us your feedback as well. You can also leave us a review and you can hit subscribe on your podcast app so you get our future episodes automatically. I'm Andrew Gray in Brussels. Thanks to our producer, Christina Gonzalez, and thanks to you for listening.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.